You're listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, the podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. Our question for the day is, happiness, is it worth all the trouble? I am your host, Dr. Noah Laracy. Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hi, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral and cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. And this week, we have Dr. Stefan Hoffman back with us again. Hello, Dr. Hoffman.
Hello, Noah.
Stefan Hoffman is a professor of psychology at Boston University, where he directs the Psychotherapy and Emotion Research Laboratory. He's also the editor-in-chief of Cognitive Therapy and Research and the associate editor of Clinical Psychological Science. So today we're going to talk about happiness and some of your research into happiness. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you found so far?
Sure. Happiness is a really complicated construct. I've been interested in the construct as it applies to therapy because I thought our field moved too far into relieving suffering without enhancing people's well-being. Happiness is part of well-being. There are plenty of examples one can think of. And if you also, I'm sure your listeners and you are familiar with the various treatments that we have for mental disorders. If you look at these kind of treatment protocols of psychotherapy, you'll be surprised how little attention is being placed on lifting people up. You're trying to make them feel less miserable. Certainly, you find certain thought patterns are not good, certain behaviors are not good, you have to sleep more, you have to eat better, and so forth and so forth. That makes you feel less miserable, but what is it that makes you feel happier? That is the question that I've been struggling with.
What is happiness? That's such a huge word.
Yes. Well, it is. So there are two basic, often people distinguish the eudaimonic happiness and hedonic happiness. Hedonic happiness being sort of a superficial feeling of that you have when you satisfy your immediate needs. Like buying the new convertible, exactly.
Or the next iPhone.
Correct. That's right. That does not have lasting consequences. That in fact, if anything, might get you into trouble. And some people call it sort of a hedonic treadmill, that you kind of get that, but then the next thing is around the corner and you need that now, your iPhone now, but you need a bigger iPhone or the better iPhone with more apps on there and whatever. And there's this eudaimonic happiness that is sort of, it's the idea that is a more lasting, meaningful feeling that you get when you do something good, that what you feel that you might have actually an impact in somebody's life. And this is now gets us closer to what I'm also trying to study, so to what extent happiness ties in to social issues. In fact, if you lived on an island all by yourself, could you ever be really happy? If you know that there's no way that you would ever be found, there's absolutely no way. In fact, let's assume that the world is gone. There was a big atomic war. You're the only survivor on an island. You have everything that you need. Could you be happy? The answer would be no, I don't think you could.
What if you make your life purposeful?
Exactly. That is the idea of eudaimonic happiness. Not living a life that gives you pleasure in terms of physical pleasure or short-term sort of emotional pleasure, but rather a meaningful life. Now, could you live a meaningful life on an island without having anybody else in the world around? That's my question to you. Do you think you could?
I'm just thinking of all of the pet lovers out there. I mean, are there no...
Nothing else.
There's no living creatures.
No.
Nothing.
No.
I think you'd be quite lonely.
It would be very lonely. Loneliness is sort of the counterpoint to eudaimonic happiness, that in a way that you live a life without meaning. It gets us actually to Viktor Frankl's issue. I'm sure you're all familiar with Viktor Frankl. This is the very thought. So you can be, no matter how miserable you are, no matter how dark, how lonely it is, as long as you have sort of hope and belief that there is that life has a purpose, that you live a life for a purpose, for a higher purpose than just being alive, but rather life that has purpose for other people later on in life, later on after you are gone, that creates happiness. That is the seed of happiness. So living in the here and now without having an impact on other people's lives in a positive way will not make you happy. It will keep you lonely and similar to this example where you live on an island without having any future whatsoever.
So all of the commercials that are out there saying you gotta buy this, you gotta buy that, you need this next new gadget, this is what will make you happy. What you're saying is...
it will make you happy in the short term. It will create this hedonic happiness, yes, but it is not a lasting, meaningful happiness that we all really need to have in order to have a fulfilled life, if you will.
And I imagine if you get trapped in that, it almost becomes an addiction.
It is exactly right. And I think we live in a world that encourages that, that focuses on monetary incentives, on drugs and other things that, it's short term, it feels good. But is it meaningful? Especially if you do it repeatedly over and over again, it keeps you away from purpose, from why are you actually in this world? These are the questions that also drive us to find answers in religion and spirituality and in philosophy. That's why these things exist in the first place, because we're trying to answer that. Why are we here? Well, and one answer to that question, why are we here, is, well, we want to have a meaning. We are part of a bigger thing, and we need to have a contribution to this bigger thing, a positive contribution. Once we feel that you actually make a contribution, no matter how miserable you are, you can survive that and you move toward happiness. Happiness is cannot be an end state. It is a process. It is a quest. It is finding sort of a place in the universe for yourself, if you will.
Can clinicians and therapists help their patients find a purpose, or is it their job to find it for themselves?
No, I definitely think therapists should help people in this quest. And you have to kind of step away from this medical model idea that we have in fixing things. And people come in with depression, they have a broken something, and we have to fix it, and then everything is good again. We need to get away from that. Obviously, we want to help them feeling less miserable. We want to help them not inflicting pain on themselves. But we also have to understand what is it they want to get, where they want to go. This ties into sort of value ideas, obviously. What is you can endure any misery as long as you're going through that for a good purpose, for a reason, and there might be an end to it, and you actually might achieve something, or not to you, but certainly for others, then people can endure almost anything.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking about all of the parents out there where they want their children to just be happy.
Yeah.
And if I can just fix this or fix that, then my children will be happier.
Yeah. I think I want my children, my boys, to, quite honestly, to live a purposeful life. I think if that's what happiness is, yeah, then we can define happiness. Do I want them to be a consumer, to simply, exist for reason to buy the newest gadget and to just, get wasted on the newest drug? No, I wouldn't want that. Do I want them to be happy? Well, it depends on what we define as happiness. I would want them to live a meaningful life. And the meaning is not necessarily the meaning placed to you, but what it does, what your life contributes to other people's lives.
And that meaning has to be defined by the individual.
Yeah.
It's not like a parent can put the meaning upon the child, or even a therapist putting a specific meaning upon the patient.
Correct. If I could give an example that was kind of striking to me, your listeners might be familiar with meditation practices, that some of these meditation practices enhance what I would call positive affect, a step toward happiness. And one of the meditation practices called loving kindness meditation, metta meditation. In loving kindness meditation, you meditate similar to sitting meditation initially, but then you focus on other people, and you wish them to be well. You wish other people to be well. This, the entire meditation practice consists of you wishing other people happiness and health and ease of suffering. It's a bizarre idea, but it's an old Buddhist practice that enhances, oddly, the meditator's sense of happiness. By wishing other people to be well, you experience wellness. We've been doing that with people with dysthymia and depression. And we thought, let's try it out. Let's see if, because they're in such a misery, people with depression feel so horrible about themselves and they're sort of isolating themselves. They live in their little cocoon and not really caring about the outside world because they are trapped in their misery. So what would happen if we break this wall? And we are not trying for them to feel better, really, but rather just meditate wish other people well. And we did a qualitative study also initially, and this is what people told us, that this is was a completely new experience for them, to step outside of their misery and to wish other people well. Why? First, didn't make any sense to them. Why would I wish other people well? I feel miserable. And all of a sudden, sort of the fog lifted and got some really dramatic positive results, that their depression scores dropped dramatically through simple meditating, wishing other people to feel well. And what's also interesting is that we had to rearrange sort of the focus of the meditative practice, because one of the steps also focusing on the self. This is part of the loving kindness meditation. So you kind of focus on benefactor, a person who you feel very close to, a neutral person who had trouble with, and eventually you meditate by focusing this metta on pretty much everybody around you. And one of those steps is also the self. You also meditate focusing on yourself and wishing yourself to be well, but you're just part of this bigger universe. It's nothing overly specific, but they had the biggest trouble doing that, in fact. They had the biggest trouble focusing on the self. So we had to move the self up in the hierarchy. They were able to wish their worst enemy to live a pleasant and healthy life before they could do it to themselves. But eventually they were able to do it, and it's really break this fog of being trapped in your misery.
So it sounds like rather than this internal focus on everything that is wrong with your life, the goal is to shift your attention to outside of yourself.
Yeah, and to meaning also as well. Yes, to outside of yourself, shifting misery outside of yourself. That's absolutely right. And to figure out what is it that you want to actually achieve in your life. We only have one shot. We're on this life once. Once. You can believe in other religious ideas that you could be reborn or whatever, but right now it's just once. What are you going to do? And not only this life is once, but this very moment is once. And that passes again. And you decide how this moment is going to be spent. And you decide how the next moment is going to be spent. It's all up to you. And it can be pretty frightening. You think about it. We wish you wouldn't have this responsibility. But really, your life is in your hands. Totally. You decide what you're going to do. So it fits into this Buddhist idea, really, of we're part of this bigger thing. We're all connected. We're all this common humanity idea that we're all linked together. And if you just live an isolated, lonely life, this is not a meaningful life. If you live a miserable life and you're soaked in your distress, this is not how you want to spend this one life that you have. It's up to you to change that.
So that's holding the person accountable for what they want to do with their lives. What if you get someone, which we often do, get someone who goes, well, I can't do anything.
Of course,
nothing I have done has improved my happiness or my satisfaction, or I don't know what meaning there is to this life.
Well, often when we hear stories like that and you dig deeper, you see sort of recurrent patterns of things people do over and over that keeps them in this trap, or wrong expectations, or expectations that are not consistent with moving toward a valued goal. So it's consistent with really ACT. I'm very consistent with this idea, ACT, acceptance commitment therapy, that you need to move toward something. You need to move toward a valued goal. You can't live a life without goal. It's like you're just floating in empty space. Yeah, you may spin or just bounce around like a ball, like a pinball. We have agencies. It's all up to us. We are the ones who decide how we're going to spend our lives and how we spend this moment.
So if someone doesn't have a purpose and they're looking for one, what are the techniques or tools that you suggest they can use to maybe help them find one?
Traditional insight psychotherapy can be actually quite useful in that regard, to figuring out what is it that I actually want. Now, it's not to say that I'm not a psychoanalyst by any means, but they are certainly trying to understand where are you going through simple questioning and trying to understand where are you now, where were you, and where are you heading? You simply ask them, what do you want to do? What is your goal in life here? And this is not obviously an objectified goal. It's like, oh, I want to have a BMW. There can't be a goal. A goal is like, and also it's even not the goal like, oh, I want to study whatever computer science. That's not what we mean by goal, but rather where you're heading with your life in much more general terms. It has to be linked to your social world. It cannot be an individual goal that you can quantify with an object or monetary incentive.
So if someone says that I've been trying to reach my goals in career, my goals in finding a loved one and having a family, my goals in connecting more with people and building my social network, and all of that has failed. I haven't been able to reach the career that I want. I haven't been able to find the loved and start a family. All of my friends are never available for me.
So I would question what success and failure means with these goals. So goals, and how do you derive these goals? Well, why are they important? I mean, the important thing is to place valued goals. What is important? Why is the goal important? Often we would, these are often traps people fall into, and they often compare themselves to other people and they want to be a little better than your neighbor and the like. This is not what we mean by goal. It has to be sort of a, what does it mean for you to live a meaningful life? It doesn't have to be at all being married. It's not necessary to live a meaningful life, or having two kids or three. It's not necessary to live a meaningful life. What is it that for you determines meaning? And the opposite, having five kids doesn't make you a, you know, a,
it might make you question the
meaning.
It
might make you question
of
it. Exactly, correct.
So it sounds like that maybe people have unrealistic expectations
correct.
Of their goals, and perhaps the goals themselves is what needs to be modified.
Not only unrealistic, but also they derive the goals from sort of too much social comparison rather than what is meaningful for them, rather than how do I compare to others.
So how would I be, how would I be perceived, how would I be liked if I had this career, if I had this family?
Correct. And often that's what you're getting with people with depression. If I, you know, this is where rumination comes in. If I just had done that, I would be in a different position now. If I, you know, you ruminate over past failures, over past events, that obviously you need to start from the current time, right now, right here. This is, you're still alive, you're breathing. Where are you going now with it next? Where's your next breath coming from?
All of this sounds very existential.
It is.
So maybe...
I really loved Viktor Frankl's book. I reread it numerous times. It's a... It's sort of very insightful, extremely modern in the thinking.
It is for that time in his life. So people having these existential questions, I mean, perhaps the point of happiness is to identify what is the purpose in your life? What is the meaning of your life?
Yes, but I think just identifying would not be enough. You also need to figuring out how to get there, how to develop the, you know, moving stepwise toward that. So for that reason, simply inside-oriented work, figuring out what you want, is not sufficient to move the person along.
You'd be just doing a lot of wishful thinking.
Correct.
Any thoughts of how do we actually get someone to move along that path? I mean, let's say someone figures out what meaning they want. How do we get a person to go from point A to point B?
At any point, you make decisions along the way. Every day you decide what you're doing. Every moment you make decisions. And the question is, are these decision points that you're making, are they consistent with where you're going with it? You want to, you're an addictive person. You kind of smoke and drink too much. And at any moment, you decide whether or not this action that you're performing right now, is it consistent with not going into this direction of substance use or not, as an example. Now, it's not just one decision point that is happening every 2 weeks, but rather the life is concurrently going on right now. Life is what happens to you while you're making other plans. John Lennon. This is right now happening. Mm-hmm. And so your actions need to be consistent with these goals. If you see it as your life as a moving object, and this movement needs to be toward this goal.
This is all sounding very acty. Which is great. Can you tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing recently with Steve Hayes? And I hear you guys have a book coming out.
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yes. So, you know, after some, how should I say, rather energized debates that we had in the past, been working together quite closely and trying to figure out how to work closely together and putting our differences aside and figuring out strategies to well, to be honest, to move the field forward a little more than it has. So we wrote a book called Process-Based CBT that identifies, based on a task force that Bob Klipek put together for ABCT some time ago. And the task force was to identify four processes that should be taught in graduate school, such as, you know, behavioral activation and cognitive restructuring and relaxation techniques and the like. So these are basic principles, basic processes. And so we thought, well, these are, you know, these are basically the building blocks of what makes any treatment, you call it, whether it's ACT, whether it's psychodynamic therapy, whether it's CBT, these are the basic building blocks. And some people call the blocks a little differently and maybe have more of these blocks and more of those blocks and come up with their treatment. And so we basically put them together as equal blocks. And we ask some representatives to tell us what it's all about, what these processes target, or how the process move people forward and illustrate them in video clips. And we've since thought that this is actually the way forward. So we need to identify these. This is not the final list of processes, but it's not an infinite list. There's clearly that at some point we got it. These are the processes that need to be targeted. Some people will differ. Some people will need more of those, others more of those. So we want to connect the process with specific strategies that are required to move this process. And then in the next step, we want to tie it to the individual and figure out on an ideographic level, what is it that we need to do with this individual to move the person in this. And that will also open up new ways of classifying people more meaningfully, getting us away from the DSM altogether.
Well, Dr. Hoffman, it's been an honor and a privilege to have you on our podcast. We really appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is completely enjoyable. Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny.
That's all the time we have today. You've been listening to the Stressless Life podcast. Send questions, comments, or episode ideas to thestresslesslife@dryip.com. Check out our website at www.dryip.com/podcast. If you like what you've been hearing, please write us a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. Until next time, stay stressless.